Judaism is the inverse, and it's a reminder not just to the Jewish people, it's a reminder to the world. Where do I come from?
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidi.
Our guest today is an author, podcaster, Jewish educator, and probably the only living Jew who's more active on Twitter than me. So here I am with David Bashevkin.
Shai, this is such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. So excited to speak with you. And really, I don't know if I'm more active than you, but I see what you've been posting. I see everything that you've been doing. And really, just as a individual Jew, I'm just so grateful for all of your voice and effort on behalf of the Jewish people.
Thank you so much. And thank you for coming and for lending your voice to all of this. And I start every conversation in the same way. I've been getting very interesting responses. But David Bashevkin, what kind of a Jew are you?
What a great question. I look at, there are three possibilities. In mystical literature, in the Zohar, and later articulated by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, he says that God, the Jewish people, and the Torah are all the same manifestation of a divine idea. God, the Jewish people, and the Torah. Somebody who immerses themselves in God and spends their time trying to understand God is trying to become a prophet. Somebody who spends all their time trying to understand the Torah is what we call in Hebrew a Talmud Chacham, a scholar. What kind of Jew is the person who spends their time studying and trying to understand and find goodness among the Jewish people? Whatever kind of Jew that is, that's the kind of Jew that I try to be. I study the Jewish people. A lot of Jews, they spend their main time studying Talmud, they study the Bible, Chumash. I want to study the Jewish people. That's what I'm interested in. That's what kind of Jew I am. I want to be immersed and I want to be able to find positivity and purpose within the Jewish people.
What's the draw? What draws you to studying the Jewish people? Because for generations upon generations, our people have almost perfected the study of Torah.
Mm-hmm.
We have created the yeshivot, the cheder.
Sure.
Like we have all the systems in place, yeshiva university, a place where you teach.
Exactly.
That's the Torah.
Yeah.
Some people, their own personal journey, trying to understand God's ways. I don't know if we haven't talked about it, but I'm an atheist. So that's not part of my journey.
Yet, I
have to say, every observant Jew sees me as a temporary atheist, and I tell them, no, it's okay. I'm a forever Jew, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But what is the draw for studying, focusing on the Jewish people?
The answer begins with, I think, why anybody's interested in anything, and that is I want to understand myself. I want to understand my own identity. I want to understand this part of myself that I did not choose, that is an inherent part of how I see the world. I want to understand me. I want to understand the world that I live in. And to really understand yourself as a Jew, you have to understand the people that you are a part of. What are they trying to preserve? I don't even think it's possible to really be an atheist and a believer in the Jewish people. We could talk about the semantics of that. But my belief in the Jewish people is my belief in God. I believe that we are a remnant. We are a people that has survived thousands of years, and we're preserving an idea. What is the idea that we are preserving? The idea that the Jewish people are preserving is that the world has a purpose.
That is very interesting. So for me, as an atheist Jew, mm-hmm. I see it. I'm 95% on the way with you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a strong belief in our people,
mm-hmm.
In the idea that we are preserving something,
mm-hmm.
and we are preserving our ancestry. We are preserving our family,
mm-hmm.
right? That to me, and the ideas of the family, and some of the ideas are in the Torah, some of them are in the Torah Shebel Peh in the oral Torah. Sure. Some are in the traditions. Some are in the family life. There's many different ways, but yeah. For me, it's the people that we're preserving.
For sure, I agree with all of that, and I think at the core of the Jewish idea, and we could unpack why this is so, is the idea of family. Undoubtedly, that is at the heart of Judaism. But I believe that in this world that we currently live in, you and I have the same data. We have access to the same data. So neither of us, I assume, have spoken directly to God. I don't have access to information that you don't have. The reason why I think it's impossible to believe in the Jewish people without God is that the atheist view of the world, if the world has no beginning, no creator, then our identities, our very sense of self, we're really just atoms bumping around. We're material. And I think anybody who looks at themselves as having a sense of self, of having an identity that transcends their physical being and feeling that they want to self-actualize. This is religious language, in my opinion. Meaning when somebody says they're an atheist, they usually are articulating the fact that I don't believe in open miracles because you've never seen them. I don't disagree with that. I don't believe in a God that is obviously intervening in the world. Obviously intervening, that's impossible. I haven't seen that. But what I think they don't understand is that having a sense of self is not really tenable in a purely scientific view of the world. It's a mirage. It's a joke. It's something that your neurons are firing on and are creating for you as a mirage. I don't believe that.
I see, but that, to me, that's the sense of self. To me, when I experience life and I truly believe that everyone around us is just a product of electrical currents in our neurons, mm-hmm. our entire views and everything. But it doesn't take even a tiny bit of the magic away, right? To me, even if it's a mirage, it's a mirage that's been created from this physical components, mm-hmm. and that's beautiful. But I think the more interesting thing for me is, you know, not the theistic conversation here, but actually the argument
you stop
that
me
you
now,
make,
because I'd go on for three hours.
No, for me personally, like we can go, but I think people, I'm interested in the idea that you say to care about the Jewish people,
yeah,
you must have some theistic view. And let me give a counterpoint. I care about my family. Mm-hmm. I am the product of my parents, Eli and Zohara.
Yeah.
Eli is the product of his parents, Benny and Leah. Yeah. And Zohara of Carol and Lydia.
Exactly.
They are the products of my great-grandparents, whose names I know. They are the products of their parents, whose some of their names I know. And I can go on and on until a point where I say, and I don't know where they came from, but I know that my family is there. Right, so I don't need to believe that my family started somewhere. I don't need a beginning. And I don't need to have that one idea that threads the entire family together to care deeply, emotionally, not just about my family that's living, but my ancestors. And I don't need a supernatural for that. But what would be your argument?
I agree with almost everything that you said. I believe that the key to loving the Jewish people is beginning with family and expanding outwards. The goal of loving the Jewish people is not to just love Jews. It's to start with your core familial identity, what I would call your unchosen identity. At the heart of Judaism, if we could take a step back, I think the biggest question about the Jewish people is why we are structured the way that we are. It doesn't really make sense that we're structured the way we are. I think that is the beginning of the key of understanding the Jewish people. If you look at other religions, or if I were starting a religion today, I would probably have some ideology, some practice, and say whoever is a part of that ideology, believes in that ideology, and continues in that practice is a part of the religion. That is how Christianity began, and that is how Islam began. Judaism is unique. The founders of Judaism are not rabbis. The founders of Judaism are not scholars, and the founders of Judaism are not prophets. That's not how we refer to them. How do we refer to the founders of Judaism? In Hebrew, we call them avos and imahos, fathers and mothers. That is the founding principle of the Jewish people. The founding principle of the Jewish people is a identity that is anchored in family. That is how we began, and the Jewish identity that we continue is immutable. The irony, and this is almost like, it's almost laughable that we always call ourselves the chosen people. The one thing Jews never choose is to be Jewish. Even a convert who would call themselves a Jew by choice, the moment a convert emerges from the mikveh, you're a Jew. You can't renege on it. There's no 30-day money back guarantee. And the question that I just love, the question, it's worth thinking about. Why are we structured the way that it is, that we are connected immutably? It can't be reversed. It can't be undone to other Jews. Why are we structured this way? Wouldn't it have made more sense? We'd have a much more pure religion. It would be a much more ideologically pure religion if the only people who we consider Jews were the good Jews. And we could fight about what a good Jew is. You know, I would say, you know, Shabbos and kosher and prayer, and you might say, you know, fighting for the state of Israel, this and that. But both of us are wrong. You're still Jewish even if you do nothing. Why is it? You're still Jewish if you convert to another religion. Why are we structured this way? It does not make sense.
So I have my answer, but before that, I want to hear yours. Why are we structured that way?
I believe that the entire existence of the Jewish people is a rumination on our unchosen identities, our unchosen identity. In the West, particularly in modern times, the way that we find satisfaction, status, and almost purpose for living is by the things we achieve in this world. You're going to be valedictorian, you'll make a lot of money, you'll have a gorgeous home. It's the status that our identity that we create through achievement. Judaism is the inverse, and it's a reminder not just to the Jewish people, it's a reminder to the world. The most important identity that we need to contend with, that we need to confront, is our unchosen identity. The very question that you asked, where do I come from? We are that question mark to the world, where in the world, even if you're not Jewish, the greatest example of an unchosen identity is existence itself, meaning nobody chooses to be alive. We're placed on this earth and we fight. We fight about what's the purpose. Is it philosophy? We fight about politics. We fight about everything. Why are we fighting? Because there's so much doubt in this world. Nobody tells us why we're here. Nobody tells us why we're alive. We have no roadmap. The model for learning how to contend with existence itself, the ultimate unchosen identity, is the Jewish people, who perpetuate this idea of finding meaning within your unchosen identity rather than your chosen identity.
So, but let me give you my version of this.
Lay it on me.
And I would say,
I feel like I'm in the Beis Medrash. I love this.
In the
Beis Medrash, study hall.
Exactly. and I can talk about that as well. I have an approach to Judaism, which I keep developing, and I think we all keep developing, and if we stop developing our approach, it dies. I have an approach that I refer to as pragmatic Judaism, meaning I try to understand, yes, what is this structure? Where does it come from? But with one assumption, again, and it's an atheist assumption, that the words in the Torah, in the Mishnah, are the words of men. Fortunately, not women, because at the time there was no women that were given the platform.
We have some women, but yeah, it's not equal.
It's very unequal.
Yeah.
But being the word of men and not the word of God doesn't make it lesser for me.
Okay.
And the way I see it is this. Religions did not exist. Religions did not, beliefs existed. We were a tribe. And mm-hmm. just like every tribe, we had a belief. We had our temple. Every, you know, there was the Canaanites, there were, they had the Baal. Like we had our, you know, we had our God in our temple, just like any other tribe. The moment we were dispersed, especially with the second temple burning down, the Jews were dispersed in the diaspora, mostly in Alexandria, North Africa, Yemen, some Iraq in the East, Babylonia. And they needed to keep us together because they saw what happens. And I say they, I think the rabbis were basically the teachers, the leaders of the groups. They saw what happens to the groups, the other expelled from their countries that disappear. Mm-hmm. So what they said is we are going to create very clear boundaries of what it means to be Jewish. Mm-hmm. We're going to make them so they are so strong that you can never, because they saw what was happening and people were forced to convert and enslaved, and we're going to force it on us that we will always be Jewish. That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. So no matter what they, whoever, it was the Babylonian, it was the Greeks, it was the Romans, whoever the they come for us, they can never take that thing from us, the Jewishness, the identity. So that was the first building block in keeping us together. Then once you have that, then you can add on more things. Once in the beginning, there wasn't conversions, but then they started dealing like, well, what happens when you meet someone who's not Jewish and you want to bring them into the fold after? So we have to give it a process. We can't just have three sentences. We want to see commitment. And then, but we want to make sure that it's a irreversible decision. So we create this idea, which is a beautiful idea, that all converts, their souls were there in Mount Sinai, at Mamad Har Sinai. For me, that is, we get to the same end point of the Jewish entity being so immutable and strong and connected, but mine doesn't require a theistic belief.
It's so fascinating, and we agree on a lot. We agree on a lot, more than you would think.
Yeah.
The difference is that when I think Judaism is stripped of its theology, when it's stripped of its cosmic purpose in the world, I don't think we would get to the end point we are at now. I don't think generations would have been willing to sacrifice, die, go to war, simply to protect, you know, a nice family culture. I think there has to be the idea of something transcendent of what the Jewish people are preserving. Now, we could fight about the language. You know, right. I don't like the word God either, between me and you. Yeah.
I have no problem with the word.
Yeah, I don't like the word. I don't like the word. But I think that this was a concern. The Lubavitcher Rebbe sent a letter to Ben Gurion right when the State of Israel was founded, I think in maybe 53, a few years or 5 years after it was founded. And he told Ben Gurion, he said, if you want this state to continue, you're going to have to confront the religious idea for why it exists. Because the first generation, they remember we exist because of the Holocaust. Then there's going to be a second generation, a third generation. We're at this place now. It is so easy to forget what is the purpose of us. I don't think, you know, we have these perpetual reminders of anti-Semitism that remind us that we are different. But I don't think Judaism would have survived 2,000 years of exile if it was perpetuating just some fabricated idea. I think there is a kernel of a divine, transcendent idea which gets to the very heart of existence itself. Why are we alive in this world?
Interesting. Now, you know, and because for me, like the point that Rabbi Jonathan Sacks made mm-hmm. in his book, A Letter in the Scroll.
Yes.
Which is a beautiful book that he actually wrote to for his daughter mm-hmm. for Day of Marriage.
Yeah.
You know, who are we? And it starts with this metaphor that if you found out that there's a book that's coming down for generations in your family. And every person, your mother gave it to you and she wrote mm-hmm. a sentence or two. Her mother wrote a sentence or two. Her mother, all the way back. And now it's your turn. And here's where I add a little bit. And your house is on fire and you can grab one thing. What do you grab? For me, it's the book. And the book is sacred. And the book is sacred not because a higher being started it, gave the words to it, but it's sacred because it has my family history and because people have died for it. It has become sacred through human interaction. Yeah. Right? So for me,
I love that.
I can treat the Torah as sacred without believing in any higher being. And the question is, can we keep the Jewish people as a people alive around that? Or do we need that also theistic God in the middle?
It depends how comfortable you are with using language. Let me state one thing. We can agree on one thing. There are only three things that exist in our world. The three things that exist in our world are the physical world. Number two is our own interiority. We have access to our thoughts and our feelings and our emotion. And number three is language, right? Those are the three components of reality. The language that we use to describe the world is, it depends how seriously you take it. Meaning, I don't think that you can use the word sacred in a real way if you don't believe in a God.
What about the sanctity of the Constitution?
The Constitution's not sacred. The Constitution is a functional document that established a state. It might have value, but the idea of the sacred is something more than that. Interesting.
So for me,
I might even believe in the sacredness of the Constitution because I think there's a sacredness to the United States of America. I think there's a sacredness to history.
So for me, it's interesting because I see the U.S. Constitution as the founding document of the United States. Mm-hmm. Israel, Declaration of Independence is the founding document of the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. And the Torah is the founding document of the Jewish people.
I love that.
And for me, it's the sacredness comes from the role it plays and the fact of it for hundreds and hundreds of generations, like of years and many, many generations, people have died or were willing to die for that. To me, that is enough to make it sacred.
I agree with everything that you said, except I don't think that when I speak to you, I don't think we stepped in fully into what it means to really, truly be an atheist. Meaning, when I think a true atheist, the atheist who I put on the atheist Mount Rushmore, you know, they have their jerseys hanging in the Atheist Hall of Fame, are people who really have almost a reductionist, I'm not saying that in a critical way, who boil all of reality down to the physical universe.
That would be me.
Yeah. You really, really do that, then a lot of the relationships that we have, you end up having to play. It's very hard to live in that world. It's hard to live in a purely...
Oh, trust me, it is. Yeah, physical, it's extremely difficult.
When you tell somebody, when you use language of saying, I'm in love with you, what does that mean? What does that mean you're in love? You're not in love. You get endorphins and your chemical. You're not living a life of mystery. You are living a life that is reduced to the very physical properties in front of you. So concepts.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit, because I do feel like, even though I am materialist in the sense, not in materialism, but in the sense that I believe that it's all physical. Mm-hmm. I don't believe. I mean, I haven't seen any evidence to the contrary. That is what I would say. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there is a test to examine any falsifiable test to examine any evidence to the contrary. The mystery to me still arrives from the fact that I know that it's dopamine and endorphins, which also end up being reduced to voltage in cells. Mm-hmm. And yet when I see my 3-year-old daughter, you know, in bed and I try to wake her up in the morning, I feel this incredible love for her. And the mystery is how that thing, that physical mm-hmm. electrical thing becomes this. But to me, it's the same mystery as when I last night was having hummus at the 12 chairs and I was enjoying myself so much. But really, what does it mean to love
Correct.
Hummus?
What's happening?
It's the mystery is how do like the bacteria in my stomach react to that and create a craving, which mm-hmm. then with my muscle
that emergentist memory, phenomenon.
That is a mystery. And just because we don't know the answer yet, I don't believe it's unknowable. Meaning 50, 100, 150 years of more of science, we will explain more and more of that process. Will we ever get to that point where we understand it completely? That is the question, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I believe that that's the path. That doesn't make it less mysterious for me. Snow is mysterious for
me. Yeah, sure, right? Sure. That's what I said. We're nearly in complete agreement because whenever I talk to somebody who doesn't believe in God, my first thing is we have the same data. I have access to all the same data as you. Where all of our disagreement, if we could even call it that, is going to be in the world of language. So when you talk about the capacity for love and you say, I love my 3-year-old daughter, and you look at her and you don't see she's made from the same matter as a table when you drill down deep enough.
Yeah.
But you don't see her as a table. You don't even see her as a creature. You see her as your daughter.
She's made of organic matter and a table is not. But yeah.
But that is already transcending the material world. Meaning, I believe that the purpose of Judaism is to transcend, to remind the world that there is more. There is a way to transcend the physical world. There is more to existence than just the physical world. So when somebody tells me that, and they'll say, when I see my daughter, I see love, I see this. So you're using the two other components of reality, language and those feelings. So,
but to me, those components are physical. Feelings are physical, even if their manifestation is experienced non-physical, mm-hmm. and language is 100% physical. You can speak, a computer can decode what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like it's sound waves. Our experiences may not be of them. But I do want to shift a little bit because
please,
you know, a lot of people listening in would be like, okay, why in a podcast about Jewish civil rights is, you know, are David and Shai speaking about
theistic issues?
Yeah,
why are we having a theological conversation?
And I want to spell it out, at least in my mind.
This gets to the heart, yes.
And here, bear with me for a second. So I was in Dallas for the Jewish National Fund annual convention. I was doing a panel. It was me and Rabbi David Wolpe.
Sure.
In front of a room full of rabbis, Reform, Orthodox, Conservative. And I introduced myself, talked a little bit about myself, and then Rabbi Wolpe talked about, told a story about Karl Reiner's 90th birthday,
okay,
where he was invited to speak and give a blessing. And he was doing this, and as he started doing it, someone jumps from the attendees and says, wait, I don't understand. I thought Karl Reiner is an atheist. And according to Rabbi Wolpe, what happened next is Reiner, 90 years old, springs up and says, no, I am not an atheist. I'm a Jewish atheist. And I think we both understand what that means.
Yes.
And the reason why I gravitate toward that story and why I want you to be here is this. When people think about atheists, they think about the four horsemen of atheism, right? Like it's the Richard Dawkins, it's
a Christopher Hitchens.
And they are
except
very
Sam Harris. I don't know. Except Sam Harris. Right? I love Sam.
But they tend to be more combative.
Yeah.
We are here to explain to you why you are wrong.
And sure. Atheism.
That's not my goal. That's
sure.
not my role.
Yeah.
My atheism is as deeply ingrained in me as I believe that anyone's belief or non-belief is in them. Mm-hmm. And it's a personal thing.
Yeah.
Yet I do struggle a lot with the idea of trying to be a person that pitches the broadest tent possible.
Mm-hmm.
Creating a true Jewish civil rights movement in the United States and around the world that includes both from ultra-Orthodox. Let's put aside Naturae Carta.
For sure.
You know, I would love them. I, the door is still open.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, the door is always open. Yeah. But from all the way from Naturae Carta to many, many other
sure
closeted atheists.
I'm with you. I know. Bring everybody together.
And to bring everyone together around the movement, a belief is already restrictive for some. It's exclusionary, mm-hmm. but in its essence, right? Because you're saying, in the same way that if I said, we are going to fight for Jewish civil rights, and we're going to do this under, you know, you have to believe in liberal values. Well, I'll be pushing out some people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to get, what is the core thing in you as a person who's studying the Jewish people? What is the thing that can connect all of us together in this fight?
You know, it's
and which is not anti-Semitism, because obviously the easiest answer is they come for us, then we come together.
That's been the case for a lot of history, and something that I've said over and over and over again, and I mentioned to you right before we sat down to interview, is that anti-Semitism, I do believe, is limited because the purpose of Judaism is not to fight anti-Semitism. We fight anti-Semitism in order to focus on the purpose of Judaism. If you want to give people a common cause in a Jewish civil rights movement, they have to understand what they are fighting for. They have to understand what is the purpose of our preservation. Why are we, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes you get like, you see in the newspapers, you know, like there's a museum that's shutting down, like, oh, we're going to lose. And like, I honestly shrug it off half the time. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I never went to that museum before. It's not that important to me. And I'm like, okay, let it shut down. Let it finish. Why is it so fundamental that the preservation of the Jewish people as a distinct people continues? And I don't know that I have language to explain that without divorcing it from all belief, but I would say something that I think there's a lot of room and resilience for how to explain this cause if you play around with the language. I'll tell you.
But before we get to your answer, I want to push on that question. And by the way, I'll be playing devil's advocate.
For sure.
Which is,
you're the atheist.
I don't know if people know. Devil's advocate is a Christian.
Yes.
Is a Christian, yes. Idea of when they decide who to join as a saint in the Vatican.
It doesn't mean you're representing
then
the devil.
You are the devil's advocate to make sure. And an interesting fact: the moment they remove that from the Vatican, we no longer have a devil's advocate. The number of people that are now saints are much higher every year than they used to be.
Fascinating. But, you know, okay.
So why do we even need to ask what's the reason to preserve the Jews? Like, and again, not to be silly, but I want to make sure that through my children and my children's children and their children will always be able to see a panda. I do not want pandas to go extinct, because pandas exist, they have existed, and I want them to make sure that they will exist. I want my children to, and their children, and all of my, anyone who will come after me, to be able to see the things and the life that we experience. Why isn't Jewish life just worth preserving because of that? We are the panda. We are,
for sure,
tiny, and we need to keep that going.
Because it's for sure worth preserving without that. Nobody should be killing Jews wantonly. But why don't we let the Jewish people run its course? Meaning, why would, have you ever thought, how much money have you given for the preservation of pandas? How much time have you given for the preservation of pandas? Would you ever pick
up? If I were a panda, I would give much more.
If you were a panda, correct. But if I knew that, like, I don't know, the last zoo with the panda exhibit is being surrounded by anti-panda warriors, I don't know if I love pandas enough to get off the couch and really get people to preserve it. I think people need to know why it's important that pandas continue, more than like, it's nice. I obviously, if I had a choice and you asked me, would you rather pandas exist or not exist? I'd say, yeah, well, let's keep the pandas. But I'm not going to fight for it. I'm not going to put my life on the line for it. What put my life, run a country just for the preservation of pandas? You need a magnificent idea in order to have the momentum that it will be perpetuated. And I don't think the Jewish people, stripped of any, again, this comes back to language, of any divine cosmic significance. If we're just one of many cultures, then okay. So we don't need that much to continue to make sure that Jews don't go extinct, but like all of the effort of preserving Jewish knowledge, thinking about things like assimilation and people just totally lose their, like, why should that bother me? I don't know. Let the Jewish people go extinct. Let them assimilate. Let them assimilate, be a part like every other. Like, we don't need anything. We wouldn't risk our lives to preserve this idea. And I think that.
So how do you make sense of the fact that many, many prototypical leaders in the probably, I guess, the secular Jewish movement, Zionism, were atheists? So Theodore Herzl, Ben-Gurion, Rabin, Eliezer Ben-Yehuda. Like, they were all, you know, non-believers. I don't want to call them atheists because they might, you know,
Ben-Gurion for sure was not an atheist. I have him on video. I could show it to you. We could play the clip.
It'd actually be nice. Describe the video.
He's asked by an interviewer about, you know, you don't believe in God. And he cuts them off and he says, no. I am a believer, but he believes in the God that is manifest through the Jewish people. And I believe that.
If I'm not mistaken, he said, I don't believe in God. And I might be getting the people wrong and I'm, you know, but which is fair. But I don't believe in God, but I believe in the Jewish people and the Jewish people believe in God.
Could be something like that. I don't remember. It's a black and white. It's a video. It's translated. Yeah. He's speaking in Hebrew. I think the same is also true for Herzl. What they were struggling with in the early 1900s was trying to figure out, where is our place in the world? Where do we come from and where should we live and exist? Let me come back to the language part, because I believe that a lot of times we use different words to explain the same phenomenon. I think there's something uniquely Jewish about different modes of interpretation, right? Jews have a four-tiered system for how we interpret rabbinic texts. It's called
Pardes.
Exactly.
I told you I'm a Jewish atheist, not an atheist.
You're the real deal. Yeah. It's called Pardes. So there is Pshat, which is a plain reading. There's Remez, which is an allegorical reading. Drash, which is like a deep interpretive reading, and Sod, which is a mystical reading. I believe that Jewish atheists are people who insist on reading the world, not rabbinic texts, but it's a way to read the world. The plain meaning, the pshat, the pshuto shel mikra, so to speak, the plain meaning of the text. When you look at the world, the plain meaning of the world, which I fully understand, and I'm totally with you, there's no God who's intervening, open miracles. That's not the way that we look at the world. But I do believe that you're looking at the same phenomenon and you're calling it a plain reading. There is a way to use different language that would give it a different meaning.
Yeah.
But it's the same phenomenon. So we could use words like sacred, like love. Some people use words like God. We use words like commandedness. These are words that allow us to go through the mystery of existence and still be anchored and not let go of the grasp that there is something transcendent in this world. There is something beyond. Now, beyond, you know, for you might hear that and say, what do you mean, the world to come and afterlife? No, beyond, I just mean that the sum total of this world is more than its physical properties.
It's interesting.
And that's much easier to get on board
with. And I would love to have an entire podcast dedicated just to this. But I do want to get to
yours. But at some point.
No, because like I can also explain my view of Pardes. But one of the things, and this takes me to the point I want to make, which is we can have this conversation.
For sure.
Because I'm the kind of atheist that will go and read the Torah.
And I'm the kind of believer.
And you're the kind of believer.
Who looks at you also as a believer, because you believe in the Jewish people.
Yeah. Fair. But then that's where I want to get. So you are a Jewish educator, and I can already see why. But if you could crystallize it to the three things that you want to teach Jews, or maybe even non-Jews, in your Jewish education, what would those three things be?
Wow, what a fascinating question. I did not prepare this. I would say the first and foremost thing is what I mentioned earlier. Number one is the importance of your unchosen identity. Don't run away from it. We live in a world and in a moment right now where I see so many people running away from their unchosen identity. They're cutting off ties with family, parents cutting off ties with kids, breaking apart. We need to realize that the number one vehicle we have for experiencing the divine is our familial relationships. That's number one, right? Number two is, I think there is something really foundational, and there's a lot to talk about. But if just as a core idea, that at the heart of Judaism is the bifurcation, is the split between a written and an oral Torah. That Torah emerges in two ways. We have a written text, but there is always an orality to Torah. Always. Even after we wrote down the Mishnah and the Talmud, there is something uniquely oral about the way that we approach Judaism, because it's experiential. Right? So there's always something about the way that we experience the world that is an inherent part of our Jewish identity. And Judaism wants you to shape not just the way that you look at texts, not just the way that you do commandments or even relate to commandedness, but at the heart of it is the way that you relate to your existence. And the way that we think about that is that we have a fixed text, it's static, it's fixed, and then there's always an interpretive component. There's always something that's emerging from the moment, from your own life, from your own narrative, from your own experiences that's confronting it. The last thing that I would say as a Jewish educator is I wish more people spoke about, particularly in this moment, to reintroduce ourselves to Shabbos observance and to Shabbos. I think that one of the great gifts of the Jewish people, it's literally described as a gift in rabbinic texts, is the observance of Shabbos, is the beauty of Shabbos. Shabbos, in my understanding, is the experience of the eternal. It's sanctifying moments. It's sanctifying time itself. And I think too many, particularly in the United States of America, have totally forgotten about the gifts of Jewish life. And I wish that we reacquainted ourselves with the gift and the beauty, and that the reward of Jewish life is in your life itself.
So,
and this, Shabbos, I think, has that.
And again, here is a place where we can both agree and get to the exact same, maybe not the exact same point, but through different paths. And I love this because Echad Am, you know, who believed in cultural Zionism, famously said, Jews don't keep the Shabbos. Shabbos keeps the Jews.
Yes.
Right? Where when we all do something together at the same time, even if we're hundreds and hundreds of miles apart, that keeps us together.
Yes.
I'll tell you two things. And again, as an atheist Jew, when I moved to the United States, graduate school, you know, your first year, all you do is read. And I found myself working 24/7. I'm an overachiever.
Sure.
I used to believe in academia this past 14 months, not so much. But at some point, I was burning out very quickly. And I decided to take a day off. And I will, a day where I will not be checking my email, won't be working, won't be reading for school, just me. I didn't have a wife and a kids back then. The easiest, the smartest, the wisest thing would have been to take Sunday. All my friends were not working on Sunday. Everything is open on Sunday. It's more fun. I chose Shabbat. Not because of some religious belief, not because God gave me Shabbat, but because this is what we do. This is what Jews do. Fast forward about 13, 14 years, this past few months, I've started been feeling burning out, that I'm always connected. My phone has become my work.
Yeah.
You know, social media and email and everything. And I've decided that from Friday night to Saturday night, I don't look at my phone. I don't use my phone for other than one thing where I call my parents and my close friends, but never text.
Beautiful.
It's all about the connection. So there's a way to keep the idea of Shabbat, which helps us connect to the Jewish essence, life, people, whatever you want to call it, which to me is then increases the idea of we need to fight for this.
We're partners in crime. We really are. I feel like we are looking at the same people and the same commandments and the same traditions. We use very different language. Like when I say, you know, commandedness, even that word, I mean, like, I was commanded by God. God never spoke to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I'll use the word commandedness to describe that existential urgency. You really want, like, you got to be something that I don't do because it's convenient. The mistake that I think a lot of Americans make in the American Jewish world is, especially with Shabbos, is they want their Shabbos observance because they, you know, somebody sells them on Shabbos. It's so peaceful. It's so amazing. It's so beautiful. And then they start give Shabbos a shot and it's very inconvenient. Always, you're never ready for it on time and this and that. And what I always try to remind people is that the beauty of Jewish life emerges specifically because it's not convenient. It's drawing you out of the routine and the inertia of everyday existence and pulling you out and really placing you what it would mean if this was transcendent. Imagine it was divine. Like, and Shabbos gives you that experience. It gives you that sense that I can touch eternity even in this ever-changing, ever-moving world. And I just wish people took a second look at it. For all of the language and for all of the urgency that we've done and that you've been doing so marvelously to fight against anti-Semitism, I think it's so crucial that we have core ideas. And Rabbi Sacks did this marvelously, but we don't have Rabbi Sacks in this moment. And what we need is people who are able to articulate with whatever language, you're doing it right now, but learning to articulate, to reintroduce Jewish people to Jewish life in whatever way that you do it. Because I believe that's what, and I think we both believe that's ultimately what sustains us, what gives us certain boundaries, what gives us shape that we haven't just fully assimilated and disappeared over 2,000 years of history. And I think I'm a big fan of, not just a big fan, like Shabbos for me in my home, I have little kids. I haven't taken a vacation in years with my whole, it's like with just me and my wife. When was the last time you were able to take a vacation? But I always tell people, I take a vacation every week. Every week we have a vacation. And like a vacation, it's hectic to get there, the airports and this and that, getting ready for Shabbos, buying everything. But once Shabbos starts, I feel eternity drop down into my home. It's in my living room. And I wish people had the capacity to even experiment with Jewish life and give it a shot.
But let me ask you this, because we have been talking a lot about Jews in the diaspora.
Yes.
And I understand, even though I might not agree with all your conclusions, I understand the danger of assimilation. That's the death by a thousand cuts to the Jewish people.
Yeah.
We slowly disappear.
Yeah.
And the assimilation can take many ways. And in one of them is this, like you say, like we just stop observing and that could be it. And I don't know if I agree with everything, but I respect that view. What about Jews in Israel? During the first and second temple, most Jews were not what you would call observant Jews. The 100%. Rules of Shabbat,
yeah.
The 39 rules of Melacha came after, in rabbinical times, right?
Yeah.
So they, but they were
debatably,
Jews.
But yeah.
Yeah. That was. Sure. But that's the.
It
that's
was
when
formalized.
They were codified.
It was codified, formalized. Much longer.
And
after.
For you know, most of the time they were go to the temple on Shlosha Regalim, right? And they would offer their, their korban.
Yeah.
The Kohens and the Levites, Kohanim and Levim, they would be in charge of that.
Yeah.
You are like
such a great example,
right? And you were just, you were not even called the Jews, you were called the Hebrews, right? Like we're a people.
Sure.
So can Jews in Israel, where we're a majority, exist as Jews but without that belief, purpose, whatever it is that you're pushing for.
This is the, in my opinion, the most foundational existential question about the state of Israel. I know that sounds crazy at a time when we're surrounded by
people. I would say a nuclear nuclear bomb by Iran is second place, but okay.
But what I mean by that is this is the most existential question to the purpose of Israel. When the state of Israel was first founded, as I mentioned, Ben Gurion was in correspondence with Jewish leaders around the world to try to figure out what should the Jewish character of this state be. And the chief rabbi at the time at the founding of the state of Israel was somebody named Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Cook after, died right before the state British of Israel was founded, and it was Rav Herzog. And Rav Herzog sent letters to rabbis around the world asking them, should we try to run this state according to Jewish law has been developed over 2,000 years? And sadly, and he was broken when he got the response. He got responses from major rabbis saying, don't bother. It's going to be too tricky. Our laws have been developed in exile and they're not going to be able to run a state. It's just not going to work. And Rabbi Herzog did not give up on it. He stopped asking those rabbis, but he wanted to figure out how do we preserve a Jewish culture, a Jewish tradition, Jewish life in a democratic state. And I love that you brought your examples from the Second Temple period, because that's how actually I understand it. In the Second Temple period, you're absolutely right. The divisions and the way that we organize ourselves now did not exist back then. There wasn't Orthodox Jews and conservative and reform and all unaffiliated. There was one form of Judaism, and scholars call it, you could read Professor Lauren Schiffman, he taught at NYU. Professor Lauren Schiffman uses the term common Judaism. Common Judaism is the term that this is what Jews typically did. It included Shabbos. It included like the basics of kosher law, like, you know, not eating pig. It goes back over 2,000 years. The Jews weren't doing that. And it had the holidays, festivals, all of this stuff. And there was like a common core of what is Jewish life. That's not the same as what we associate with Orthodox Judaism today. It's certainly not conservative, and it's definitely not reform. It's none of those things. Common Judaism is a Jewish idea and practice that has the capacity, at least in potential, to reach the entirety of the Jewish people. And
because it's focused on the life.
Exactly.
Not necessarily on what you believe in your mind.
Exactly.
But what you
it's do. It's focused on the life and the rhythms of life. You know, when Jews born, life cycle events, there's a way Jews get married, et cetera, et cetera. And there is a way that a state could, so to speak, integrate this in a way that is healthy, non-coercive, but at the same time, preserving the Jewish idea. Sadly, we have not figured that out yet. And I believe, and I think Hamas knew this, that a lot of the fights that we saw in Israel right before October 7th about judicial reform, but all these things are still the trauma and the energy that is reacting to this fundamental underlying question. We have not yet figured it out as a people. And I believe that at the heart of what we still need to figure out, you're right, nuclear war, enemies, for sure. But we fight anti-Semitism so we could focus on the purpose of Judaism. If you were to ask me, what is the most essential, urgent question for the Jewish people? Not any government, not any party, the Jewish people. We need people coming together and really thinking about this and learning from history in the way that they approach this question is what should the common Judaism of the state of Israel be? What should that be? What should that look like? And unfortunately, I don't think we have the right players in that room right now. Everyone's just jockeying for their model to win. No one's going to win. Common Judaism, everybody's a winner, or everybody's a loser.
So let me ask you this, because, you know, and I obviously am a poster child for this, or not a child, but I believe there are many people out there, I meet them, who look like me.
Yeah.
Tattooed, sure. Which is, you know.
I'm trying to see what their pictures of.
There's many, only seeing a few, that are, don't believe.
Sure.
Do some things, but not others. Do we have a place in this common Judaism?
Undoubtedly, Undoubtedly, you are crucial. That was the starting point. There is a reason why Judaism is structured the way it is. Anybody who would say no to that question is a heretic. They're a heretic in their belief of the Jewish people. Meaning, if I were to say you have no place, I'm looking at a Jew, you are as Jewish as I am, to say that Jewish life does not have a place for you, a place for you as you are, as you are.
No, it has a place for me, but am I a, so here's the
reason. Are you a voice in this question? Yes. Absolutely, of course you are. Of course you are. The beauty of the state of Israel and why it's so magnificent and why I feel it's so redemptive is for the first time in history, we're being forced to confront this question. The existence of the state of Israel forces the Jewish people to articulate, now that we have two things, freedom and power in the state of Israel, we are forced to articulate on our own terms. So what should our common Judaism be? The problem is, we have so many distractions, and the distractions are people trying to kill us, anti-Semitism. There's a lot of distractions right now, that it's much easier to focus on those problems than the us problems, than who are we? Where do we come from? What are we trying to perpetuate? What should Jewish life look like in 100 years from now? Do we want to see traditional Shabbos observance? Do we not? What would traditional Shabbos observance even look like in a modern state of Israel? These, to me, are the questions that are most essential for our people, for the next 100 years from now.
So let's play the Hollywood game where, you know, we're writing a movie, but it's not a dystopia, it's a utopia. Yeah. Maybe it turns out a dystopia, I don't know.
Yes.
We snap our fingers.
Yes.
No more anti-Semitism, no more enemies of Israel. The Jews are left alone. No more hate for the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Do we disappear? Do we become fundamentalists, orthodox to keep ourselves? You know, the most ultra-orthodox is to keep the path going.
Sure.
What happens?
I definitely, God forbid, I don't think the Jewish people would ever disappear. I think without anti-Semitism, Judaism in America, in the diaspora, is challenging, has become more and more challenging because the gravitational pull of assimilation is so strong. It is very hard to perpetuate that sense of difference, of uniqueness, of purposefulness on an individual level without anti-Semitism. But I believe in the state of Israel. If the state of Israel finally, you know, did not have enemies surrounding it, you would be able to build a population, a civilization, and a country that would literally be the model to the world of how to balance our individual selves with a collective identity. This is everything that the Jewish people model for the world in just the political science of it all. I mean, the Jewish people should be and can be, we have capacity to be the model for the world of how we preserve a unique collective identity while still giving room for that individual identity where everybody has a place. I don't think the state of Israel should be mandating belief in anything. I couldn't agree more with you. Even the notion of mandating belief is kind of laughable to me. I mean,
no, but it's never tried to mandate belief. But one of the big tensions in Israel between secular,
yes,
what we call dati and chiloni, which is also a weird distinction, but is the mandating of traditions,
yes,
not the mandating of,
yes,
belief.
So I think in the state of Israel, we have a lot of it in place. The state of Israel runs on a Jewish calendar. The state of Israel speaks the language of the Jewish people, namely Hebrew. And the day of rest is Shabbos. Yeah. And you have off for all of the holidays. I think the questions that we don't yet have an answer to, that are big questions, that are serious questions, that Jews don't like talking about, is number one, the definition of a Jew. Who is a Jew? That's a controversy that has hovered over our people, especially in the diaspora where it's become very messy. How do we define what makes a Jew? That is a major, major controversy that we need the best minds, the most thoughtful people, not just of Jewish law and Jewish life, but of the Jewish people to articulate that. And I think in a time of freedom, we would have that capacity. And I think the ultimate purpose of the Jewish people is to raise up what it means to raise healthy, joyful, emotionally well-balanced families. It's a straight verse in the Torah. Through you, all families will be blessed. The Jewish people should be the model of what a healthy family life is all about, and bringing that, frankly, to the world.
Before we end, I want to ask you, because
was this insane? We talked too much theology on this?
We talked so much theology, and I did not expect this. I didn't get to talk, and I have
what
you again.
What did we miss?
We didn't get to talk about Daf Yomi, your podcast.
Oh, my gosh.
We didn't get to talk about 1840, your other podcast, your books. You wrote a book about sin and evil, and I'm fascinated by that.
I blew it.
No, you blew me away rather than blew it. But we're going to end really quick, and I'll have you back for more conversation. But because we can learn from our Mekorot.
Yes.
And I don't even know what the English word for Mekorot would be.
It's sources,
but it's more than sources. It's our fountains.
Yeah.
Our
foundational sources.
Yes.
Yeah.
We don't need to reinvent the wheel. We can learn from them, despite our differences of whether we believe it's the word of God or the word of men. We can learn a lot from them. For an aspiring Jewish civil rights activist, where should they look? A character, a story, a biblical or a Mishnah inspiration?
I would look to the first dialogue where we're even introduced to the notion of persecution and anti-Semitism. The first time persecution and anti-Semitism is mentioned in the Torah is a conversation between Abraham, who is known as one of the Avos, one of our forefathers. And Abraham reacts to God. God reveals himself to Abraham and says, I am promising you this land, namely the land of Israel. I am the God, and God reveals himself as the God who took you out of Ur Kasdim. I took you out of the fires of Kasdim. And Avraham responds to God. Avraham is the Hebrew pronunciation of Abraham. He responds to God and says, how do I know? Come on now. In Hebrew, he says, Bame Eda Ki Irshana. How do I know for sure that you're going to give me the land of Israel? Like, how do I know?
It, to be fair, is a good negotiation technique. And, you know, you don't take promises, you know, empty promises. Give me guarantees.
And God answers, you're going to be slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and the fourth generation is going to be redeemed, and you're going to get the Torah, and you're going to go to the land of Israel. What is this dialogue? God reveals himself to Abraham. Even if you don't believe in God, within the rules of the text, God comes to you, tells you something. You're not like, can I have a down payment? Can I have a deposit? You know, like, how do I know for sure? Pinky swear? Like, what's he asking God? How do I know? What Avraham is asking is the most fundamental question in the entire Torah, where Avraham is reacting to the way God introduced himself. God says, I'm the God who took you out from the fires of Kasdim. That's that famous story. What happened in Kasdim? It's a famous story where Abraham jumps into a fiery furnace rather than worship idols. He gives up everything rather than worship idols. And God says, I'm the one who miraculously saved you. And Abraham realizes something, and this has been the underpinning of our entire conversation. Abraham says, how do I know that future generations are also going to be able to be a part of this? You just told me you're the God who miraculously saved me after I literally was willing to give up my life. What about in 20 generations from now? I'm going to have great, 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 great grandchildren. They're not going to be such believers. They're not going to be that involved. They're not going to be willing to give up their life for all that much. They're not going to be willing to give up their life. Forget about idols, Shabbos, tefillin, davening, prayer. They're not going to be that interested. How do I know that your promises to me are not just to me because of what I was willing to do, but to me because of my family? And that's where God actually changes the script. He says, whoa, whoa, whoa. If you want that, if you want an immutable identity, an identity that is passed on no matter what, we have to introduce something else to the equation. And that is anti-Semitism. Because anti-Semitism is unfortunately our reminder that our identities are immutable. And that what makes us Jews is not because we were willing to give up everything, not because we were willing to jump into a fiery furnace. What makes us Jews is because of where we came from. And I think that is a core message of understanding What is Judaism a reminder of? And what is anti-Semitism a reminder of? What are we fighting against? What we're fighting against is the reminder that the non-Jewish world is giving us, the haters of the Jewish people, those who hate the Jewish people, not all non-Jews hate Jews, but what the haters of the Jewish people are looking at us and saying, your identity is immutable. You can't change it. We just want to get rid of you. And the Jewish people say, exactly. Exactly. What we are perpetuating, who we are, is not something that we earned because we're the best Jews in the world. It's not because of our beliefs. It's not because we were willing to jump into a fiery furnace. It's because of the family that we are a part of. Judaism begins as a family and only afterwards becomes a religion. That, I think, is at the heart of our civil rights struggle. What are we fighting for? We are fighting for the family that is the Jewish people.
We don't drop mics here, but this would be a mic drop moment.
I don't want to. These are expensive.
This mics. And I didn't pay for these. I do not. So I can't. This is no. You're right. And again, the beauty of this that we can have a conversation.
Yeah.
And honestly, like every time you say the word God, for me it's another character in the story. And I can relate, but it doesn't matter. I relate to the story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to
relate. Because it's your story.
Because
it's your story.
Yeah.
And that ultimately is why I agree with you. I'm not looking for God out there. It's in here. Mm. It's in here. It's in the language. It's what we bring out into the world. Can I say one thing
that
which brings it? There was a dialogue that had a big impact on me between Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's a scientist, and Norm Macdonald. Mm-hmm. Norm Macdonald is one of the great comedians. He was not Jewish, but he was a lover of Jewish mysticism and Jewish philosophy. Loved it. Norm Macdonald, I always look to comedians. I love comedy. Neil deGrasse Tyson shared on Twitter years ago, Norm Macdonald passed away, said, the universe is uncaring and indifferent to all of your sorrows. The universe doesn't care. And Norm Macdonald responded in the most brilliant, I think theologically brilliant response I've ever seen. He said, Neil, there's a fallacy in what you're saying because you just said the universe doesn't care, but I care and I'm a part of the universe. So by definition, the universe can care because I'm a part of the universe and I actually care. When we talk about God, when we talk about love, when we talk about anything that transcends the material world, I'm talking about people. I'm talking about you. I'm talking about me. I'm talking about our capacity to remind the world that there is more than just this material universe. There is a way to bring in caring, compassion, kindness, sweetness, love, relationships. And I believe that the core of the mission of the Jewish people is to bring that second layer of interpretation on the static physical world, almost like the written Torah and the oral Torah. We have this static world that we're given. I didn't make it. You didn't make it. We're kind of handed to a tradition. And then we have our own oral capacity where we interpret, where we find meaning. We bring in sensitivity. We bring in love. That's what you're doing. And yeah. I think that's what the Jewish
people are
trying to do.
And to me, again, I just want to make clear, like I completely am a materialist. I believe that there's nothing more than the physical world. Mm-hmm. And yet, when I see a cat suffering on the street, and I understand that it's just mechanical, and I understand that in the long run, the cat will not exist, I will not exist, none of this will exist, the world, the sun will explode and nothing will exist, I will still help that cat. And it doesn't matter if there is another world, if there is another layer.
Because you're my kind of believer. Because when you help that cat, the universe is no longer indifferent.
Mm, I love that. So we end every episode with what I like to call the Jewish lightning round. A series of questions.
I didn't prepare for this.
You cannot prepare for this unless you did your homework. It's a list of questions.
Just rapid
say
fire.
Whatever comes to
Let's
mind. There's
it.
No right or wrong answer.
I'm so excited.
You can get one pass. I'll just tell you if you get the pass.
Okay.
You can ask for one. David Beshevkin, what is one thing people don't know about you?
That I'm an oversharer, that people do not know about me. I don't want to pass on this, but I'm trying to think of something that people generally don't know about me.
It's a tough one.
I'm trying to really find something.
Look, to be fair, you have two podcasts.
Yeah,
you
know, I share a lot.
One of them it's is only, daily. They know everything about you.
It's only because I share a lot. What people don't know about me is that anything that you see online about me, anything that you've read of all the words of everything that I've achieved in this world, my true self, who I am, and my existence begins with my wife and my children. That's it.
What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
That to understand Christianity, to understand Islam, to understand all world religions, I believe, begins with a serious and deep understanding of Judaism and understanding how we relate and how all world religions were either critiques or pushbacks or taking the Jewish idea and bring it to the masses. I think in this moment, especially over since October 7th, it's crazy to have world global affairs and the only thing we know about is the politics and nobody understands the theology behind what's been happening. I think it's a huge issue and it's part of the reason why this has been such an intractable war. We should understand what Islam is better, we should understand what Christianity is better, and we certainly, as Jews, should understand what Judaism is better.
What is your favorite curse?
It's so funny. I so rarely curse because I'm so mindful of language, as I said before, of creating the universe. But the only people I curse in front of is my wife and my mother. It's the people who I'm most vulnerable in front of, and I don't want to give away their secrets.
All right. When was the last time you cried?
Last week. I average about 3 or 4 cries a year in a good year. It happens very rarely. But when I cry, it's the most refreshing. I look at it as a gift. I'm usually crying because of the ineffable weight of existence in the universe. You feel like it's weighing down on you, and there's something so beautiful about crying. And I cried last week.
To tell you that as an atheist, hearing that someone who believes also cries about the ineffable weight of the universe makes me feel good.
We have much more in common.
I know.
Me with an atheist, I have much more in common with you than almost any other religion. Because, I see the world you see, and I love it.
If you could have any person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
My grandfather, Rabbi Moshe Bukritsky, who passed away. He was the first graduating class of Yeshiva's Chafetz Chaim. He was a great sage known as the Chafetz Chaim. It was started by his nephew, and he got sick at the end of his life. He broke his hip. He had Parkinson's. He eventually got lost really his memory. The only thing he remembered, he was a Baal Koreh, so he was able to read from the Torah. He forgot everything at the end of his life. The only thing he remembered and stayed with him were the verses he could read from every verse of the Torah to the day of his death.
Wow. What is your favorite Jewish holiday?
It used to be, I went through three stages. When I was in yeshiva, it was Purim.
Got a drink.
Yeah. Shiva was in Purim. When I was single and lost in my 20s, it was Tisha B'Av. I think it's Tisha B'Av, which is a holiday of mourning, is an underrated holiday. I find it to be so cathartic, so rich with symbolism, ideas, exile, redemption. But my favorite holiday is Sukkot, because it's a holiday that I hated. I hated sukkahs. I didn't even like sitting in the sukkah, especially when I was single and I didn't have a family and a home of my own. I found it very isolating, and I didn't think I needed reminders for how temporary the world is. And sukkahs itself is the holiday of rebuilding, of taking the sukkah out from the garage and rebuilding it. And I rebuilt sukkahs for myself. So now it's become very dear to me. And I love sukkahs. And sukkahs is the only opportunity you have to bring Eretz Yisroel, to bring that sense of being in Israel into your backyard in the diaspora.
Mm. What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
This is going to sound nuts. It might be Hanukkah. I know that's crazy, and people hate that. Hanukkah, I find, is overrated with the thematic ideas of Hanukkah. I don't find that interesting. I evaluate
Jewish civil rights activist, I respectfully disagree.
Yeah. But I don't find it that exciting. If not Hanukkah, then I think the hardest Jewish holiday is Rosh Hashanah. Mm. I'm always, the whole Rosh Hashanah, I'm like, what are we supposed to be thinking about today again? Yom Kippur, I get repentance, personal, like I get that. I have a very hard time and I'm getting closer to it, but I have a hard time with Rosh Hashanah. Huh.
When do you feel safest?
When I'm at home in my bed and my children are asleep and I'm home in my bed.
When do you feel least safe?
When I am pitching somebody, I do some fundraising and this and that. When I am pitching somebody on the importance of the work that I am doing, and it's clear that I'm either not doing a good job of explaining why this is important or I'm not being heard, there's nothing that drains out my sense of self than feeling deeply misunderstood.
What gives you hope?
The Jewish people at all times. The Jewish people are the model, are a testament at every moment that the Jewish people are crying out, don't lose hope. That's what we're crying out to the world at every moment. Rabbi Nachman says that. What it means to be a Jew is to never lose faith, because the very founding of the Jewish people in our story was a couple who was infertile, 100 years old, were never going to have kids, were never going to have a family. And that's exactly when we began. That's when Avraham and Sarah had their first child. And Rabbi Nachman and another Hasidic teacher, Rabbi Tzadok, writes that there's a reason why the founding of the Jewish people began after losing all hope. Mm. Because we're the reminder that there's always more hope in the tank.
Wow. What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
Martin Luther King and Heschel standing side by side, where Heschel famously said, you know, when he said, why are you doing all these protests? And he said, I was praying with my feet. I look at Jewish civil rights as a form of prayer, but you're praying with your feet. You're praying by protesting, by going to government, by going to politicians, by going to people of power. That is an act of prayer. It's prayer through action. And I look at that as any time that we are hoping and looking at the world and hoping is an act of prayer. And Jewish civil rights is founded on that commitment that there's always more prayer and there's always more hope.
That has to be the title of the episode, Praying With Your Feet. I'm just saying, telling Achi, the producer, he does what he wants, but if I had my say, that's the
end. Or an atheist spends 45 minutes talking about parties and theology.
And then call it Praying With Your Feet. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want the listeners to donate to this week?
Tomchei Shabbos.
Tomchei Shabbos, what is that?
Tomchei Shabbos is an organization that provides Shabbos meals and Shabbos food to people in poverty. And the fact that as a people, we have organized ourselves and it's run by volunteers and they drop off the food by somebody's house, it's very private. Nobody knows. It's very discreet. I get like emotional thinking about the work of organizations like Tomchei Shabbos, that the Jewish people, we've been through so much and we have so much stress and so much danger. But even in that moment that we're looking out for one another and making sure that part of being a Jew is being able to have access to the comfort and rest of Shabbos, that's what we're all about.
Where can people find Tomchei Shabbos?
You could Google it. There are divisions of Tomchei Shabbos, I believe, throughout the world, certainly throughout the United States. And Tomchei is spelled T-O-M-C-H EI, I think. Tomchei Shabbos.
Yeah, and Tomchei is supporters.
Exactly. So,
yeah, supporters
people who
of Shabbat.
Support Shabbos.
David Beshevkin, where can people find you?
I'm pretty easy to find. I'm on Twitter at @dbashideas, and you can follow us on. And I post all the stuff that I'm doing, all the articles and podcasts. But where you could check out our podcast at 1840 18 FORTY. Our website is 1840.org. Again, 18 FORTY.
Well, this has been probably the most philosophical and inquisitive conversation that I've had, definitely in this season, but probably in all throughout our podcast. And I'm just very thankful for you to being here, and I can for me to be able to say, so here I am with David Beshevkin.
This is my absolute privilege and pleasure. Hineni, it was a pleasure being with you.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."